Kia ora, te alofa, hi and welcome to another episode of Tanerumanga's Team Talk, proudly sponsored by Victual, New Zealand's first health and wellbeing supplement range that combines ancient Māori and Pacific wisdom and ingredients. My guest today is the great Dan Carter, born and raised in Southbridge, New Zealand, one of the true superstars of international rugby, winning two Rugby World Cups and playing 112 test matches for the All Blacks. He was named the International Rugby Board Player of the Year three times and has won three Super Rugby titles with the Crusaders. He's the most capped All Blacks fly half of all time, and he's the top international point scorer in Test rugby, scoring 1,598 points, which is just finished a charity kickathon, kicking the same number of kicks as he has international points for UNICEF through his DC10 fund, giving back to children in the Pacific Islands, which is great. And I've just checked on the website, currently having raised over $400,000 so far. Well done for that. And he's now a co-founder of Glorious Digital, a digital art company involved in NFTs. And he and his wife, Anna, are also brand ambassadors for the Chemist Warehouse. And he owns a share of Parnell department store, Faraday's, which sells luxury fashion and clothing brands. Good to have you on, DC. Thanks for making time. And as you heard, you're a very busy man, so I really appreciate you giving up some time for me.
Thanks, Tana. Thanks for having me on your podcast. I've been involved in a few of your team talks over the years. None as probably serious and business orientated as this one. It was normally trying to G the boys up or give them a bit of love, mate. So there was probably 15 years ago now. So it's nice to reconnect again, mate. I noticed you didn't give any of the Super Rugby stats, Crusader, Hurricane, in that intro either, mate. So I'll take that on board for how much I share today. thanks for having me on the podcast and looking forward to having a chat.
Oh, mate, that's probably your intro is probably longer than some of my team talks, mate. So it's been a different kettle of fish, you know, getting into podcasts and into business, which is, you know, what we'll talk about soon. But you're right. I was hoping that you didn't notice that I didn't mention the Crusaders in there. You know, it's still.
Smart. So I was going to say, because you didn't, then, you know, I feel like the listeners should know a little bit about your rapping skills. And I can't believe it took 19 years. Even recognize you had these epic rapping skills. So when I signed up with the Blues in 2019, Tana, it's become a bit of a ritual with the Blues. Maybe once or twice a year, he'll come in and he'll do a rap for the boys, and it just blew me away, bro. Oh, geez, I was absolutely stunned. So here's a wee hidden talent for your listeners out there that didn't know that.
Oh, you've outed me, geez. I thought it's just going there, are you? How was that when Rangi rang you up? You know, you'd come home and you'd retired from finished in Japan. Well, yeah, you retired in Japan, eh? And then all of a sudden, oh, I'm going to get back into it. First of all, how'd you sell that to Honor?
Yeah, Honor was okay. It was more my dad, proud Cantabrian, that I was nervous about giving that message to. And so what had happened, I was finishing my second season in Japan, and I'm a bit of a control freak, and I really wanted to finish on my own terms. And we had a really successful first year at Kobe Steelers in Japan. We won the top league, first time in since the inaugural top league, close to 20 years ago. And it was a really special moment, and I'd signed a two-year contract under the coaching specialties of Wayne Smith, which we've both worked alongside, and obviously one of the best coaches that I've ever been coached by. So to work with him at the end of my career was something really special to me. I played six games in my second season and then got forced home because of the pandemic. And at that time when COVID first hit, no one really knew what to expect. So I thought I was just coming home for a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
My family was based in Auckland, and I was doing 6 months in Japan, 6 months in New Zealand, and it was really challenging. So being away from the family at this stage, we'd had a third child, so got four young boys now, so Rocco was just born. So to get up and leave New Zealand was really hard. And I remember walking into my apartment in Kobe and going, no, I should be home with the family. So I went straight to Smithy. I said, no, I'm struggling. Like this season's going to be hard. Is for the first time I felt like I should be with them. He's like, well, what do you want to do? Do you want to leave? You know, he was really open to do anything. I was like, no, I just wanted to share it and express it. But because I'm feeling like this, I'm going to give everything that I've got to this season. Because I know now, for the first time, I know this is my last season. Because it's not that I've lost the love for the game, but all of a sudden, for the first time, my priorities have changed. I needed to actually start being at home and being a father, being there in the weekends for the kids' sports. Things like that. So I put all my energy into my last season at the Kobe Steelers. And then when the pandemic hit, it was a great opportunity to get home and be with the family. And as time went on and the borders started closing, they were still adamant the Japanese season was going to go ahead. And in that time, you know, we'd been in lockdown here in New Zealand and Leon, who's a good mate of mine, had started planting the seed because Stephen Perifetta had injured himself and he started planting the seed. Well, you know, do you want to come help us out? And I was like, no, I can't. I'm a crusader. Like, I can't. He's like, oh, come on, mate. And I was like, no, I couldn't. And then we got the news that the Japanese season is cancelled. So for me, that was my career over. So I was a bit gutted, to be honest. And I remember my son Fox, he saw me when I was gutted and he was like, oh, what's wrong, Daddy? I was like, oh, look, they've just cancelled the season. He goes, oh, so you're not going back to Japan? And I was like, no. He goes, oh, that's the best news ever, and gave me a big hug. And he's like, oh, I'm so happy about that. You're not leaving? And it was the first time it kind of really hit home that I was like, okay, well, you know, I should probably finish playing. But then when the opportunity came up to play in the city that I was now living and the family living in Auckland, I started thinking twice about it, and Rangi kept hounding me. And he eventually got me at a weak moment out on the golf course and I said, bugger it, okay, I'll come along. It was just the Super Rugby Aotearoa. It was only, what, six games or, you know, there were eight games. It wasn't that many, but I was like, oh, geez, now that I've said yes, the competition starts in 2 weeks. How am I going to get prepared for this? So I knew I needed about 4 weeks to prepare to play again. And I looked at the schedule, and week four was the Crusaders against Blues down in Christchurch. And I was like, oh, no, I can't be playing that. Thankfully, Rangi made my training program, so I was available to play the week after that against the Hurricanes. Unfortunately, I got injured a couple of days before that game. But the hardest conversation was with my father. So he's, you know, proud Cantabrian, huge Crusaders man. So I made the phone call to Dad. I said, hey, look, you know, Leon's talked me into helping out the Blues. And he's like, look, like he has all my career. He said, that's great, you know. So I'll support you whatever you do. So good on you. It'd be good to see you back playing in New Zealand. But I just need to tell you one thing. When you play the Crusaders, I just hope they don't beat you by too much.
It's good loyalty.
Had a support in a funny way, apart from when we're playing the Crusaders. But no, it's good. Like going into the Blues facilities, working with the likes of yourself, Dan, Leon, you know, great Tom, great coaching group that you had there. It was great to be back in the team environment because I'd been in lockdown for 3 months and I was missing rugby. I was missing the team environment. So I came in with no real expectations. I thought, okay, I'll go in there, I'll just help the young guys. I drove back from that morning. I was like, man, I really want to play. And I did. And I was still a bit gutted that I wasn't able to play through injury. And then we missed the last game of the season as well because we went back into another
lockdown.
Snap lockdown, which was a shame. So I did a lot of training and eventually I felt good enough to play that I went and played for my local club team, Southbridge, after that. I played about four games for them. We went and won the Coleman Shield that I'd never played for or never, you know, played for before. And there was, I didn't know at the time that was going to be my last game. And looking back now, having hung up the boots, it was just such a nostalgic moment to finish my last game playing rugby for the the same club and the same team that I played my very first game for as a six-year-old. So it all worked out in the end, and that's the beauty. But I did enjoy my time with the Blues. So, never thought I'd be putting on a Blues jersey, but there you go.
Oh, and your dad must be happy because, you know, the Blues got you ready for, you know, that final stint at the family club.
Exactly, yeah. So there's one thing is, so where I grew up is Southbridge, and then the neighbouring township is called Leeston. And Leeston are red and white stripes, so I was never allowed to wear red, even though Canterbury's, you know, red and black. I was never allowed to wear red because it's Leeston colours. Southbridge colours are blue and white stripes. And the funny thing is, through the, I think it was the 80s, when I was a young kid, Auckland were dominating provincial rugby. So much so, as a young sort of 6-7-year-old, I was watching Fitzy, John Kirwan, the likes of those guys. And I used to tell Dad that I wanted to play for Auckland. And it used to break him. He always, he was like, well, you got your dream, play for Auckland, even though I never played. So he'd often have me on about that. But no, I did put on the blue and white hoops of Southbridge after training pretty intensely for the Blues for a few months.
Nice. I think two things come to mind when you came, and that was obviously, you know, we looked at and you hadn't been doing any training prior to coming to us. So, you know, naturally what your playing weight was to what you'd come to us was, I know that was a bit of a concern for you because, you know, we'd just come out of lockdown. You've just come out of lockdown. And I remember you coming to me after your first contact session. Oh, actually, I think I'm a wee way off here, guys. I think I've got to go back into the gym and get my body ready to handle just training at this stage.
Yeah. Hey. Oh, I got pretty close. The pies, the trainer, doing sessions, just trying to get some more muscle bulk. Not only had I been in lockdown for 3 months where I hadn't been to a gym or training, I was still, you know, running just to keep fit. But also, I'd just come from Japan where you tend to drop a couple of kgs in Japan because there's not the same physicality as here in New Zealand. So you can play a couple of kgs lighter because the game is just so fast and played at such speed with less contact. So with those two things combined, when I did my first contact session at the Blues, you did right. I was like, oh my goodness, it's going to be tough. But I knew in the back of my mind, if I could just put on a couple of kgs, feel good, that my mind and my body would just take over when I was out on the field. Like I had all that experience behind me, even though I might not have been at my peak, I still felt I would be able to get to a level that I could not let the teammates down. And that's the biggest thing for me. I don't want to go out there and underperform or let the side down. So I would have never played if I didn't feel like I was in a position to play. And jokingly, I probably could have played the Crusaders game the week earlier, but we pushed it back another week to the Hurricanes week. I felt ready to go. And why I injured my calf, old man calves, who knows? The tender age of 38 or 39, whatever I was, but mentally I was ready to go. And, you know, I was pretty disappointed. I felt like I let a few people down when I did get injured.
Oh, but I think that other side of, like I said, there's two things that really stood out. And that experience that you've just talked about, like having you on the field as soon as you got back, from a coach's point of view, it was like we became redundant because having someone like yourself, you know, coach from the sidelines in the team rooms, but actually having someone that running around with these young players and being able to correct on the spot while they're running, and just seeing our guys' faces light up when you just offered, you know, that experience. Oh, I wanted to just try this, you know, and, you know, if you just got over there, maybe, you know what I mean? And that really came through hugely. And I know the players love, you know, running around with yourself, but that ability to coach on the spot was I think, a big thing that I'm sure our players grew from, you know, it helped them further on down the track.
It was one of my favourite parts of the stint that I had at the Blues was being able to share my experience. So I went there with wanting to try and help the younger guys. And I always knew the Blues always had talent, you know, and how it was coached or managed through time, I didn't really know. And so one of the first gym sessions, I went to Patrick Tuipulotu, who was captaining this side, an amazing lead. I was like, can I come to the leadership meeting? He was like, absolutely. I wasn't sure whether you wanted to or not. I didn't want to ask. I was like, no. If I'm in any team, I need to be in the leadership meeting. So I just almost just walked in there. And I felt like we made some real progress with the leaders in the team. And they're really young leaders. It was the likes of Dolts, Papali'i, who's obviously now captaining the side. Rico Ione's been around, played a lot of games, but still really young. They had a really young leadership group. And I felt like that's where I was really able to help Patrick drive and, you know, get that group functioning at a really high level. And looking back at my time, that's probably one of the things I was most proud about, was how much I was able to offer my experience and knowledge to these young rugby players. And, you know, they all wanted to learn. It was an amazing environment to be a part of. Leon and the management group, like yourself, have done so much work on the culture of the group. So that's something that really shone out when I was there. I was like, okay, look, they've absolutely nailed this. They're fit. And now if we can just bring the leadership element, you know, up a few levers to start challenging each other, start, you know, getting some good work ethics, some good habits into their weekly plans, then I knew then that, you know, they'd be a dangerous side. And we've seen that over the last couple of years, the success that they've had and, you know, the improvement that they've been making.
And that's probably one of the hardest things to, exactly as you said, the challenging each other, those hard conversations. How do you get players to understand, or get people to understand, you know, having hard conversations is actually good for everyone? You know, don't, I think who else said it? It was, I remember Bowden said it, you know, the standard you walk past is the standard you accept, you know? So how would you implement, you know, having those hard conversations into any team or business?
I mean, yeah, it's not just sport. It's business in general. I think the key thing is understanding the vision of your business, the vision of where your sporting team wants to get to. So whenever you're challenging, it's not because you don't like them. It's because you're putting the team first and you're wanting the team to walk towards this greater goal, this vision, this purpose. So I think if you have a culture that everyone's buying into, then they'll soon understand that it's not an individual thing. It's a team thing. I'm just wanting the team to get better. So, you know, one of the early leadership meetings that I went to, guys didn't turn up with their book, you know, and they literally just rocked in on a Monday, hadn't even thought about what they were going to talk about in this leadership meeting, and it blew me away. And I hit a couple of them up, like, have you actually sat down last night and thought about what went well last week, or what can we improve this week? And they hadn't. They just expected Patrick to get up and lead the meeting. And I'd been in a meeting by that time, and he was doing an epic job. It was incredible. But there was only one or two people speaking in these meetings, where this is the leadership group that has a lot of experience. We need to be really open and sharing. So I felt like I needed to try and get the best of the individuals in that room. And if I walked out of there and didn't say anything, it would have happened exactly the same the following week. But all of a sudden, you challenge a couple of guys, I know that next week they're going to do the work. They're going to be prepared to talk and deliver and give their messages. And it was, and they knew straight away that I wasn't just trying to be a dick or I didn't like them. They knew that, okay, well, he's come into this culture of excellence. Now he needs to, like, we need to be living excellence on a daily basis, and just rocking up and expecting someone else to do the work that's not excellence. So a lot of it is just that understanding of, you know, where the team is wanting to get to the vision, and then just you know, breaking it down from there.
Oh, that's awesome. Hey, I wanted to talk about, you know, you've played in a few countries now too. you know, and we've seen the improvement of France and the improvement of Japan, and you know, you've talked about New Zealand with the World Cup coming up. What was your impression of those three countries playing rugby? It's probably been a little bit since you played in France, you know, our time in France. But did you know, like, what did you enjoy about it? Did you see the improvements, and what are the improvements and the differences between the three countries?
Yeah, three completely different countries, New Zealand, France, and Japan. Like, the cultures couldn't be more different. So from a personal experience, I was just so grateful to have that opportunity. In terms of rugby, I always knew that going to France was going to be challenging. I had a six-month sabbatical down the south of France at Perpignan, so I knew what to expect at racing. Mm. I've seen so many Kiwis go over there and just pull their hair out, just frustration. They just wanting to be doing things in France how we did it here in New Zealand. So I knew that it's a completely different culture. The majority of the team do things differently. We had French coaches, so we were going to be doing it at their way. So I sat throughout the first 3 months and didn't say a lot. And I was just taking it all in. I was learning their style, their delivery, how they like to do things, because I knew I wasn't going to make big changes straight away. So understanding how they did things in their culture was probably the most important thing for me. Mm. And then after I got a good gauge of that, I was able to just, you know, just some slight, whether it's adjustments or opinions or talking to the right people about how we can, you know, just try some new things. We ended up making the European final, and we won the top 14 my first year there. We didn't have a leadership group, and we didn't have a game plan. It was crazy. It was just, you know, a scrum. You know, you tell the forwards where you're going. Okay, we're going to go to the width. We're going to go wide. So all the eight guys would get out of the scrum, and they'd run to the width. The first three guys would get that one, and then the next ones, just whoever's there, would. There was no accountability. It was crazy. So I was like, there is so much growth here.
Mm.
Didn't have a leadership group, so I was like, we've got some great players within the squad. We could form a really strong leadership group that could, you know, help this team be really successful. We can challenge the coaches.
Mm.
Something I learned through that time as well, that the coaches were never challenged. No. They basically ran everything. So you go to a debrief, they'd talk for an hour, no input from the players. They would talk through the following day on defense strategy and attack strategy, and it was only the coaches talking. Once again, there was no involvement from the players. And in New Zealand, it's so player-driven. The coaches do the work. They deliver to the strategy group. And then the key guys in the strategy group, they're going to be playing that weekend, they deliver the game plan. And that wasn't happening in France. I was like, oh. And my second year there was really tough because I was trying to make change, and they didn't like it.
No.
Well, to have a one-hour leadership meeting in the middle of the day when they're wanting a three-hour lunch, that didn't go down well with a lot of the Frenchies. But at the same time, you know, we gave it a go. We had an amazing coach there, Laurent, who's now the backs coach for France.
Oh.
And so he was desperate to try and bring in game plan. You know, was it a formation? I think we had a 2-4-2 for a while. And it was the first time that they'd tried this. But, you know, you get the loose forwards who are supposed to be hanging on the edge. They've felt redundant, so they thought that, oh, I need to get my hands on the ball, so they would get out of shape, and it just wasn't working. So there was some real frustration there, but through time in that season, then my third season there, it all clicked. It's like, oh, these guys actually want a leadership. They actually want to put the team first, because it's quite individual over there. We started working with the coaches a lot more, the strategy. Guys have had a year now of learning a little bit more about the importance of game plan and saving energy. And with the All Blacks, you're always wanting to be adding to the legacy. Mm. You know, you want to leave the jersey in a better place than what you got it. And every team that I've gone to since the All Blacks, that's been a focus of mine. When I finish playing at racing, I want to feel like I've add a little bit to the jersey. And even though I had a few injuries at the back end of France, I still felt like with the leadership group and strategy and some of the ways that I was able to implement some slight subtle changes. It weren't so subtle year two. It was not too much for them. But I was able to really help them with professionalism and how they could look at playing the game. And then so I was really proud of things that I'd achieved at racing. I was going to finish playing then, but then Wayne Smith signed a contract at Kobe Steelers, and he asked me to come to Japan on the way home. And I was like, look, I can't turn you down, Smithy. So when I went to Japan, it was how we used to do things in New Zealand. It was a New Zealand run management, and it was amazing. After 3 years I had France, it was like, okay, cool, this is a bit more like home, and I was able to slot in straight away. One thing that the New Zealand coaches did really well with Wayne Smith and another guy, Scotty Hansen, who's coaching down the Crusaders, they were challenging me, and I'd been challenged for 3 years. They were asking questions of why I was making those decisions, the work that I was doing off the field, everything. I was like, oh my God. It was quite, confronting at first. I was like, no, this is what I need to continue to drive me. So it was really good, that experience in Japan. But the one thing that I learned is that with the Japanese culture, they're very, quiet. They just want to work hard. So our sessions were only an hour, maybe an hour and a half, and they're used to doing 3 hour sessions. So they would just continue, the Japanese boys would just continue to train, just start running like an hour after training. And I could see the New Zealand coaches going, what's going on here? Like, they just think, more is better. So it was a real challenge of having to go, well, actually, no, let's focus on quality, not quantity. Because they thought quantity, the more you do, the better you are.
Yeah.
And I absolutely respect their work ethic. They work harder than others in terms of, their book work, their homework. They're always on their iPads studying the game. But out on the field, they were just smashing themselves, wondering why they're probably a little bit tired before the game. It was a great progress for them. And how we did it in New Zealand with the players delivering the game plan, always putting your hand up, giving opinions, talking about what you see or what you feel. The Japanese, their hands were almost under their legs. They didn't want to put their hands up and answer questions. So that was a real change that needed to happen. And the coaching group really pushed the Japanese boys hard just to try and share what they're thinking and have that real team growth. So there was some subtle changes in all different parts of the world that I played. But the biggest learning was they're not going to be done the same in each country, and it's not a matter of just going, right, well, we did this in New Zealand, so we should be doing it here, because that's just not how they think. So it's how you can fit into a culture and then just bring your expertise, your knowledge, without trying to completely change everything.
That's probably a good and I've spoken to others about that, and coming into be it a team or a business or a club, and you're the new guy in and you have all this experience, you might be the CEO, and how are you able to enhance or help that culture grow? The way you enter, is really important, rather than, we've heard guys come in, I've just won a World Cup. And now I've come into France. Now, this is how we do it with South Africa. This is what I'm expecting. And straight away, every other player around is, well, who are you to? We've been here for 3 years and we've been doing this. This is good for us. You know what I mean? Yeah. How would you, what's your kind of, again, your tips around entering those kind of environments? Like, you just kind of said, hey, you've got to enter, do your time. Is it do your time, find out what the lay of the land is, and then work a little bit of magic and behind the scenes?
I think depending what role you're going into this new environment, you know, if you're going into a business and you've been employed as the CEO, like it's your responsibility. Yeah. So you can't just do your time, be quiet, yeah. be patient. You need to take control. So before you go into your role, you need to do the research. You need to understand the people that you've got working for you, the past performances, the vision. You know, one of the best things about the All Blacks, I think, and the culture is always looking back at the past. You know, we respect the history.
Mm.
And then it's your time to add to the legacy. So that works in business as well. Let's look back at this business and let's work out times of real strength. You know, the originals, the invincibles. Let's actually take some inspiration from those past teams, past players.
Mm.
So I think if you're going in at a really senior management level, you need to do the work before you start so you get a really good understanding of where you can take this business or this team. Whereas if you're just an employee going into a role, I think, you know, you need to just take your time, earn the respect of the people around you was one of the biggest things that I learned going in to the Crusaders for the first time. I had all my heroes in the same changing room as me. You know, if they went to mum and dad's house, you know, there were posters of Mertz on the wall. You know, there was Reuben Thorne, Justin Marshall. Like, I idolized these guys. And whether it was just because I was a young, quiet country boy, I didn't want to come in and go, oh, we should be doing this, we should be doing that, because I know they go, what the, you know, who's this guy? So I was like, I want to use this time to learn from the people around me, but I also want to earn their respect. How do you earn their respect? Well, in the sporting environments, it's simple. You earn respect by your actions.
Mm.
So I was always out on the training field. You know, always first out there, always last, you know, really, you know, fitness testing, trying to challenge Ralphie, who was the fittest of the Crusaders at the time. So always trying to challenge the guys like that and just basically through work ethic and through time and through experience, you feel more comfortable in the environment, and that's when I could start answering questions a bit more or talking to the coaches a lot more as well. So I think there is in certain roles that, you know, there's time where you just got to earn your respect.
We all know from the earth, goodness grows. Victual, New Zealand's own health and wellbeing supplement range with native and Pacific ingredients. Visit victual.co.nz and take your first step to help your goodness grow. Obviously, the 2005 Lions series for you was like a coming out party. Do you think in terms of internationally, not nationally, you know, but, you know, you had a great series, you know, that was kind of the catalyst for you to go on and, you know, you won the World Player, the IRB Player of the Year. But as I look back on it, and it's similar to what Jonah, if you think about John Alumu and the World Cup, you know, and we see that picture of him running over Mike Catt, and that's the kind of, you know, with the growth, and that became brand Jonah A. And, you know, similar to that second test, you know, the amount of points you scored. Did you feel a change into the, you know, the perception of yourself, not from yourself, but from others, and how, because you'd know too, young players now, it's all about the brand, and how my personal brand. And for us, we struggle with it a little bit who've come from, you know, everything's about the team first. Yet now that I'm in business, you actually understand, actually, we all do have our individual brands or, you know, our personalities that we've got to make use of in this platform of rugby. Is that, would that be the first time you actually felt that, you know, that was something that was going to happen to you? And how, you know, has that been, you know, that kind of journey, getting on that and then, you know, from what you've achieved to now?
Yeah, I think the Lions series put me maybe more on a global scale.
Mm.
Like, you know, like I'd like to think rugby fans knew who I was, you know, before 2015, having a couple of successful years with the Crusaders and the All Blacks. But no one really thought that, you know, I could have achieved the heights that I did so early in my career, and everything just went so well in that second test match. You know, I remember remember us being a little bit annoyed after the first test match. We had a good win, but headlines were not about the good win. They're about some other incident that happened in the first test match. And you held so much, you know, mana within the team, and it felt like it was a personal attack. And I still remember it so clearly that we wanted to play that second test match for our leader and you. So there was a little bit of extra motivation going into that game. And as a young 23-year-old, you know, I wanted to, you know, sew up that series after two test matches. So I prepared as well as I possibly could leading into that game, but I never thought that I'd have a game where I had just so much control and flow. I was young. I was a little bit probably naive, and I just played with such freedom. What I was doing, hanging out on the wing, scoring that try down the sideline, I'm not sure. No one really talks about that. Hanging out on the wing. But it was. And playing in such a iconic series, like a Lions series, that doesn't happen, you know, very often, you know, once every 12 years here in New Zealand, it really put me on the international stage where, you know, with all the international rugby media were suddenly talking about this young number 10. And, you know, with good performances and big occasions like Lions Series, World Cups, opportunities come, sponsorships. And at first, it was all a bit weird because young country boy, you know, pretty sort of quiet and reserved, doing, you know, sponsorship work. Obviously, I had a really good management group around me that were good friends of mine that I just trusted, so I kind of just went along with whatever they would say, and so I said yes to most of the things early on. You know, some that are still, you know, come back to haunt me every now and then, like the Vortex Mega Howler ad, you know, the jockey modelling that I did. But you know, you live and you learn, but you also understand, you know, the power of, you know, building a brand. And I still think you can build a personal brand within a team environment, where a lot of old school guys are like, no, you can't. Why are you doing individual deals when it should be the team first mentality? And I agree with them if the individual ever loses focus on the most important role. And for me, that was rugby. So I always put, if I did say yes to anything that's going to distract, deflect, like put any harm in what I'm trying to achieve on the rugby field, then I've made a mistake and I should have said no. So as long as my major priority was rugby first and nothing that I was doing was going to get in the way of rugby, then I felt like it's okay. It's okay to build a brand, to have sponsorships, to jump on social media, to do, you know, magazine shoots, whatever it was, as long as I was performing on the rugby field. And I felt like I was able to balance and juggle that really well. You know, if I had a great 2005 Lions series and then the next few years were awful, it means I didn't have that balance right. The fact 2006 was a fantastic year for me, 2007 was going okay until the quarterfinals. But I had some really good years being able to balance, you know, the work that I was doing off the field, and it was not getting in the way of the work that I was doing on the field. So making sure that you continue to really focus on your priorities and making sure that nothing that you do gets in the way of that. Because another thing that I learned, that the more you prioritize and perform during your priority, the more opportunities that come from a branding perspective. So I've seen on a few occasions young guys come in and they focus too much on their brand, whereas if they had a great 5-6 years playing, then you'll reap the rewards, you know, from a branding perspective once you've done the time. The thing is, it happened really quickly for me. 2005 was only my third year playing professionally, and that's when a lot of the opportunities came. But I continued to like, okay, well, that's the standard on the rugby field. I need to just aspire to get better and have this growth mindset of continuing to get better each year that I played. And I still remember my very first test match That's when my dream became a reality. I never actually thought I was going to play for the All Blacks, but 2003, you were playing outside me in the 12-13 jersey, and I walked off the field in Hamilton, and I was like, I should have been really satisfied that I'd just achieved my dream, but for me, it wasn't enough. I was like, I don't want this feeling to ever end. I don't want to be just another All Black. I don't want to play 5 test matches. I don't want to play 10 test matches. I want to aspire to be an All Black great. Mm. I'm never actually going to achieve that that vision. But it's something you walk towards.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, well, I don't want to be just another All Black. I want to be an All Black great. Well, what does that look like? Okay, we've got to play for over 10 years. You got to evolve as a player because you can't just play the same game for 10 years. You need to evolve as you go. You need to work harder than all your opponents and the young guys challenging you for position. So when you have a vision or a purpose like that, I know Richie had a very similar purpose, is when you have a good year or a good game, a good season, that's not it. Like, you need to do that consistently over a long period of time. So with these opportunities that were coming off the field, once again, going back to my purpose of not being an All Black but being an All Black great, it's okay, I'll say yes to those as long as I don't get in the way of, you know, these train tracks that I'm trying to walk towards. I never actually get to the end of my career and go, yep, you put the flag in, I'm an All Black great. You never actually achieve it. But it's something that you're always walking towards, and, you know, if you're in that conversation one day, then you've obviously achieved some pretty special things along your career.
Oh, I'm sure. You're definitely in those conversations, Desi. So at this stage now, when did you start thinking about, obviously you got all these opportunities and, you know, that's right then and there, and you start thinking, well, actually, I've got to think about what's going to happen after footy. You know, did that, I think I read something where, you said, I think it was around 25, 26 where you started thinking. And again, that's still at a young age to have that thought in your head.
Yeah, I still remember my first year or two playing professionally. I lived in a garage at my mate's flat, and it was the most pumped out garage ever. I had the latest plasma TV. I think plasma had just come out then. I had a mean sound system, and I was blowing all my money. just living the dream, shouting the boys out on a few big nights out and things like that. Anyway, I started like saving lots of money in the bank. And I was like, okay, but what do you do with this money? Like, I didn't know about investing. I didn't know about business. I didn't know about the other opportunities. I just thought you put all your money in the bank and you buy a house and then that's it. So I did that. I bought my first house in, I guess, 2005 or 6. And then it's like, well, what do I do now? And then, so there was a business opportunity with gas with some friends, and I was just so naive. I didn't know. I just said yes because I felt like I needed something. And that was a great learning experience into business. It didn't go well. We went to liquidation. It was around the global financial crisis. So it was a really difficult time to go into retail in particular. But it was a great learning. And through that time, around 2007, 2008, I kind of took a step back, and I was like, well, okay, well, I want to play this game as long as I can. So when I get to the end of my playing career, I'd love to have a passive income. And I started thinking of it like that. So if I have a family when I finish playing and I'm earning a certain amount of money through my portfolio or investments, then I'm doing pretty well because I could retire and have an income without having to do anything. And I was really lucky to be introduced to some good people that were able to help sort of mentor me and advise me around investing my money, not just putting it in the bank. So I set up a couple of portfolios that, shares, bonds, property, you name it, just a really diverse portfolio with different risk managements. And then I was lucky enough to play for another 10 years. So through that time, I was just, investing, my income, and it was just creating a passive income. So I didn't do a lot of businesses through that time because, with startups and other opportunities, you can invest a lot of your capital I was like, no, well, I'm just using this next 10 years just to build this up. And then I eventually retired last year, and I was, you know, in a really good position to do that. It was off the back of the work that I'd done, you know, for the last 10 years. And now I had some capital to maybe be a bit more risk adverse. So yeah. I actually, you know, invested in a few other sort of startups, and because I had the bones of the investments all sorted, so I had the financial security for my family sorted through that investing that I did. It was a really good learning curve, and there's a part of me wish that I did it earlier, so it could be more. But I think that's just a part of, you know, part of growing and learning is, you know, how many 21, 22-year-olds think about, you know, investing for the future? Not many. So,
no.
Yeah, but it was a really good learning for me. So the businesses that I was able to get involved in a later stage were because, you know, I'd saved and invested enough for financial security that I can actually, you know, have a bit of fun and be a bit more risk averse to the other opportunities that can come up. And if they don't work out, it's not like I've got all my eggs in
one basket. Oh, that's great. And yeah, like you say, you talk to everyone, you know, and all you do is, I was even having a discussion today with some business people, and they were talking, all you see from, you know, successful business people is the successes. Yet when you talk to them, all the successful business people talk about is their failures and the you know, the great learning. I got great learning from this by doing this, and, you know, but everyone thinks, he did it. It must be pretty easy to get to where they are. That
definitely. No. Now. And it's the same in rugby.
Mm.
And I was just been over in the Gold Coast with Richie the last couple of days, and I asked him the question. I was like, well, if there was one test match you could take back, you know, what would it be? And both of our minds went straight to 2007, the quarterfinal.
Mm.
They looked at each other, and they were like, are you talking about the 2007? I thought about it at first. He goes, me too. He goes, I wouldn't change it. And he's like, no, neither would I. And I was like, the reason that we had so much success in 2011 and 15 was off the back of that failed World Cup. We knocked out in the quarterfinal. If we didn't have that, we were successful, we would not have had the decade that we had from 2010 to 2019. We had so many learnings around walking towards pressure and having the tools to deal with pressure, to be able to control our mind, all these incredible learnings from that failure that helped us be successful. So I think it's the same as business when you're talking to these business people, that they do, that they focus on their setbacks and failures, because that sets you up and it gives you the learnings. We all know that life's not perfect. You're going to have setbacks, you're going to have failures. It's the same in sport. It's, you know, you can dwell on it, get upset, or you can learn from it, and that's where you get the real growth.
Well, that's what you said before too, the growth mindset. You've got to have that mindset to be able to, you know, take the actual lessons from those failures to be able to move ahead and make sure you see the warning signs when they start to come up again, eh?
Yeah.
So you're into this new world of Web3 and NFTs. So how's that going? I see it. You have to have a lot of research, from what I've heard, to get an understanding about it.
Oh man, it took me about 6 months of research, to be honest. So when I finished playing last year, it was a really challenging time for me because I knew what my purpose was throughout my rugby career. My professional career lasted 18 years. And I just wanted to be the best rugby player I possibly could. So every time I got out of bed, like, well, what does that look like? I was inspired. I wanted to go out. I wanted to train. I wanted to work hard. I wanted to be the best I possibly could. I wanted to be better than I was yesterday. That real growth mindset that we've talked about. And all of a sudden, you hang up the boots. And it's like, well, what next? You know. And there were a lot of opportunities coming to me, you know, in terms of investing in businesses, being a part of startups, and the temptation and the sort of FOMO of missing out on some of these opportunities getting the better of me. And I just wanted to say yes to almost anything off the off chance, or maybe that'll be successful, maybe that'll be good. And it was a quite a dangerous situation for me to be in. So I talked to a lot of friends and family around it, and that was probably one of the best things I did, is I talked to people. And I remember talking to Rob Fyfe, the ex-CEO at Air New Zealand, and built a friendship. And I was just sharing my experiences of the difficulties of not having direction of this next chapter in my life. He goes, there's someone you need to talk to. So he put me in contact with Kevin Roberts and the old CEO of Saatchi & Saatchi, and he's done a lot of work with ex-athletes before and sporting teams. And we had one conversation via Zoom, and he was like, right, this is us for the next few months. We're going to repurpose you. I didn't really know what that meant, but we broke it down, and it was really confronting to have to all of a sudden talk about who you are, your character, your beliefs, things that I want to take from my sporting career that bring into the next chapter of my life. Things I'm passionate about, things that I love. We got to the end of it. We did it for about 6 months, and all of a sudden I had this framework of, you know, my values, pillars, that things that I'll never do. So all of a sudden when opportunities come to me, well, does it sit within my purpose, the direction that I want to go for my life? And it was one of the most rewarding things that I've ever done. So all of a sudden I was able to say no to opportunities, whereas I probably would have said yes. It didn't sit under my framework, things that I'm really passionate about. Mm. So with Glorious, it's like, well, where does this new technology Web3 thing come into, my pillars that I'd sat down and my beliefs? So there's a guy, Scott McCliver, who is a partner at PwC, and he helps me with some tech opportunities. If I, read a proposal, it all looks good to me, but I put in front of his eyes, he just reads straight through it, goes, that's pretty risky investment to be a part of. But he started talking to me about blockchain technology, NFTs, cryptocurrencies, and like most people, it all went over my head. So I don't even know what you're talking about, mate. So he started sending me some YouTube videos, and he's like, just watch these. And I did it for about 6 months. And at first it was all going over my head. I was like, man, this is crazy. But then the penny dropped when I started to think about athletes and how it could work for athletes or sporting teams. And all of a sudden I saw this another commercial opportunity, some more revenue for players if they were to do an NFT project or invest in this new technology. So it started to excite me. And so he introduced me to another guy called Murray Tom, who's really big in the music and art space here in New Zealand. So the three of us, we started talking about this new opportunity, and that's where we formed the company Glorious. And at that time, through lockdown, NFTs were just going crazy, billion-dollar businesses. It was just, it was a real mega trend. And we're trying to work out where the Glorious fit in the market. And Murray brought in, a guy called Tim Harper, who's now the CEO, who has an amazing art background. And we brought in Mike Heron, former QC. We got a tech company called Silo here in New Zealand. We built this team together, and we worked out where are we going to sit in the marketplace. And it soon became clear to us that we wanted to sit in the premium end. We weren't like digital collectibles where you're buying, collectible cards for $10 like NBA Top Shot was. We wanted to sit in the premium high end, because not many people were doing that. And we've had many conversations with sporting entities, and it really resonates well with some and others not so much. But we've stayed true to our values, and because we've stayed true to our values, we've worked with some of the best artists here in New Zealand. We're talking to some of the best sporting entities in the world. We managed to just land Wimbledon.
Awesome.
So we're doing their NFT project later this year. So they really loved our high-end masterpiece NFT It was all about legacy enhancing, legacy protecting, and you know they've got an incredible history at Wimbledon, and they want to do a project that enhances their legacy, and so that was a huge win for Glorious. And it's still the thing that we're learning is it's still such a new area, this new technology, and it's the new blockchain technology that it all sits on is the thing. Ask me to explain blockchain technology, I can't. the fundamentals of it, and that's where people get confused. It's like asking someone how an email gets sent in a second to Japan when you send an email. Like, you don't understand how the technology works, but it does. So it's a new, you know, exciting thing that I'm constantly learning, and I just love that, because when you finish playing, you know, I finished on a high, had an amazing career, and then often what sports people want to do, they want to go into their next chapter of life at that level, on that high. Where I had some great conversations with Tim Brown, ex-soccer player.
All Birds,
and you know, followed his journey, and he shared a lot about his experience, and he said one of the best things that you need to do when you finish on such a high is to almost go backwards. So you need to learn new things. You can't expect to go, if you expected to go from finishing rugby on such a high into business at that level, you're going to fail because it's almost like at a CEO level. You need to be learning. I'm sure that's what you're going through
100%.
At the moment, like, you're actually learning, and that's awesome. So there's this period where you're learning new things, whether it's around marketing, communication, business, the mindset of consumers, whatever it is, you're learning. And that's something that I love, because I knew I could have gone into coaching and straight away, but I was like, no, I just need to just try something new, and with this, you know, new technology and opportunities for athletes and sporting entities, it's something that, you know, that I have really, really enjoyed.
I was just listening to you. You're exactly right. I was just, oh, that's right. You know, if yourself and Tim Brown have said it, then I'm not stuffing up too much by going into learning, because I'm definitely learning a lot, because it's all brand new to me.
Oh, if we think that, you know, through your 20s you should be learning, or even teenage you're learning, so like, oh, man, you know, we're in our 40s and, man, I don't know how to do this. I don't know how to do a PowerPoint presentation. You don't need those things as a rugby player.
Yeah.
So it's perfectly normal to actually – he's got a great graph for me. It's like, okay, so you almost have like three peaks in your life. So your first peak is like your sporting career. And then you can't peak again from a peak. So you need to go down or backwards, and that's where you're learning. So usually the next year or two of just learning, because your next peak, you're going to take all that experience and knowledge from your first peak, and you're going to accelerate even faster. So you do that in another part of your lifespan, and then later on in life, you probably have another one as well when you feel like you need change. So what you're going through and what I'm going through as well, it's perfectly normal. So it's nice to get reassurance from someone like him, who's, you know, extremely successful businessman, and everything he's done with Allbirds, you know, he's kind of at his second peak, so I'm sure he's probably trying to work out, you know,
what's next. Yeah, 100%. No, that's great reassurance, I think, because sometimes you do get a bit, oh, what have I done, you know? Hey, what have I done?
And the other thing that's I found as well with business is, because with rugby, every week you're getting feedback.
Okay. Yeah.
So you work really hard. So every 7 days you're getting feedback. With business, it takes so much longer. You know, it's like, oh man, are we doing the right thing? Oh, are we moving on the right track? Oh, these setbacks, like, what does that mean? Whereas we train, eat well, be professional. Oh, we lost. Okay, we didn't quite. Okay, now we've got 7 days to turn that around. Oh, now we're getting better. Okay, we won that game. Okay, we've got better next week. And you just get constant feedback, where in business it takes longer. It could be, you know, 6 months or a year before you know whether you're moving in the right direction. So I've really struggled with that a little bit as well, not having that constant feedback every weekend of whether you're doing the right thing or not.
Well, yeah, I know exactly what you mean too. Like, even when you're training, you know, you drop a ball. Oh, yeah, well, that, I don't, you know, it's, I didn't have my hands up, or, you know, so you've always got a reason why Whereas, and I think it's also if you're working with different people who, because, oh, look, I'm used to making mistakes. We don't want to make mistakes because it could, you know, because you're going into a bit of an unknown. We don't want to make too many mistakes otherwise. So you kind of get into that anxiety space around,
And you become hesitant.
Yeah.
To go back to your sporting things you learn, you need to make mistakes. Similar to what we were talking about before, you need to make mistakes to grow. Otherwise, you're just going to be safe. You're going to be sort of mediocre. You're not going to push boundaries, challenge. So you need to have the right framework and vision, and then, you know, be bold, be brave, and learn from those mistakes. It's okay to make mistakes. Everyone makes mistakes. It's not okay not to learn from those mistakes. So I can only imagine it'd be quite challenging at times because, you know, where people aren't used to experiences and things that we've learned on the footy field that then go and help us, you know, in business.
You have you because I did my first pitch to invest. You know, you're talking about investing. I'll have to do my pitch to you, mate. I did my first pitch yesterday, and I tell you, and look, don't feel offended or actually, I was thinking, you know, I prepared just like you do, you know, we did before a test, you know, I like had my music on because, you know, they said, listen to music before you pitch to people. And then I even went to the 4 hours before. I'm going to eat 4 hours before because it wasn't 2:30 in the afternoon.
Butterflies like before a test match.
Yeah.
And that's when I realized it's like, okay, well, I need that nervous energy again to know you're doing the right thing.
Yeah. Oh, and you know what? I thought of you, bro, like when I was prepared, because you know why? Because I knew I was talking to you today. And remember, we used to sleep because of night games. We used to sleep during the day. And I remember having this talk with you. I think it was in Aussie sometime. And I was, what do you do, you know, when you get up after sleep? Because, you know, I'm the same. And I just get up and I'm still a little bit jumping, you know, before we go to the walkthrough, and you're talking about, oh no, I have a cold shower. I had a cold shower. But all that kind of stuff comes back, that's what, you know, you're preparing for an event and you're out in front, you know, like, as you know, pitching. And apparently I was right. I made a couple of mistakes, and that's where, again, that ability to made a mistake, I'll just straight back into it rather than get into that, you know, that thing Smithy used to talk about, getting into quicksand, mistake, trying to fix that mistake, and then you do another mistake, and then you just go deeper,
that downward spiral.
Yeah. Oh, that was so funny, mate.
Awesome. Yeah. I know exactly what you're talking about. I think it's just whether that's something we've learned from playing at the highest level, that pressure, that expectation, knowing that you need to do the work. You can't just turn up and deliver.
Yep.
So if you think that you can just turn up to a pitch or a meeting and just deliver, your name's Steve Hansen because that's what he called it. He was an absolute genius at delivering. He was epic. I'm sure he was doing a lot of work behind the scenes.
Yeah.
He wouldn't give too much away. But outside of sport, have those moments again where you're like, okay, I can't just turn up. I need to work for it. I need a proper preparation. I've got these nervous butterflies. It means that dealing with that pressure again is like you can let it just overcome you and you're like, oh no, this is too much, or you can walk towards it. And that's something that I've learned from being a professional sportsman. I want pressure like you experience for that pitch in your life. I want that regularly because it means you're on the verge of being successful or moving forward.
Yeah.
So it's a great feeling to have.
Yeah, well, they say, hey, pressure makes diamonds, isn't it? You've got to have it.
Absolutely.
Hey,
can't believe you had a cold shower, though.
That's what I'm doing a better try, though. We're getting older now, and, you know, what do you do for your health and mental well-being? Especially now, again, you're so busy with a lot of things on the table.
Yeah, it's I really need to have sort of structure, and like you, got a house full of kids, so it can be, you know, quite challenging to find time to to train. But for me, being active, I go crazy if I don't. Get outside, go for a run. If I'm starting to get a little grumpy or agitated, it's because I need to exercise. So exercise is a big thing for me, just in terms of my mental clarity. Just go out for a run. So I've actually found myself doing a lot of running since hanging up the boots. So exercise is a big one for me. The other one is nutrition, and something I probably didn't focus as much as I would have liked on throughout my rugby career. You know, I was young. You know, we're training. I could get away with it. But like you said, now we're getting older. You know, we actually have to understand more about what goes into your body and the effects that, you know, that it has. And I'm very grateful that my wife's you know, starting to be a naturopath. So she is all over nutrition, health and well-being. She's an absolute master. So just seeing what she feeds our children is you know, really, you know, it's inspiring because, man, I used to have a pie and Coke for lunch when I was a young kid, steal some of mum and dad's milk money and go buy a pie and, actually for breakfast, pie and Coke before the bus picked me up on the way to school.
Nice.
So nutrition's a big part of that as well. I'm a real firm believer of, you know, 80-20. I like to enjoy myself, you know, earn myself, you know, a cold beer in the weekend. But, you know, 80% of the time I'm really focusing on what goes into my body, sort of, you know, what fluids, what nutrition goes in. And I have such a much better understanding now than I did as a 20-year-old, even through my playing careers, of the importance of eating good, clean, healthy food. So between exercise and nutrition, that's a big part of helping me with you know, my mental clarity, my mental state, and, you know, looking after my body.
Hey, DC, look, I appreciate your time, man. I know you're busy, man. I can, you've got a few things coming through at the moment. So thank you for coming on board, bro, and, you know, giving us some, and me especially, you know, some, you know, I obviously listen to you because, you know, I took the cold shower and now I'm listening to you in business as well. And I wish you all the best for, you know, whatever's coming next. And yeah, I'm going to see you in Spain soon. So that'll be fun. And
awesome. Yeah, good. Looking forward to that. No, thanks for having me on the podcast. I really enjoyed it. I am no expert like you. I'm still at that real entry level of business. So I'm no entrepreneur or anything like that. I'm learning as I'm going. Like we were rugby players and then you were a rugby coach and now we're embarking on this new journey. But what I love is this growth mindset of wanting to learn, wanting to get better, using the knowledge and experience that we've learned from our past to help it. So I'll be following you know, your journey. And to be honest, I was like, wow, he's finished coaching. And I'm really excited to see what he's getting involved with. And I love this family business that you've started. So I wish you all the best. I know from you and your personality and your lovely wife that it's going to be successful. And you know, as your experience, you know, success doesn't come easily. With the work ethic and the right people around you, you know, slowly but surely, you know, I'm confident that you know, you're on the right path.
Oh, I appreciate it, brother. And yeah, I'll be following and watching your journey as well, bro.
Cheers.
Appreciate it, bro. You take care.
See you, mate. Bye.
Thanks for listening. Make sure to check out Victual's website at www.victual.co.nz so you can rebalance your lifestyle with ancient wisdom and ingredients.